J'ai jamais compris comment danse le Charleston. J'ai jamais compris comment danse le Charleston.
Samuel Goldwyn of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer said, "It's absolutely impossible, but it has possibilities." This is the Producers Lounge Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Tucci, and on this week's episode, we have producer Donna Wheeler, who is an entrepreneur, filmmaker, artist, closet poet and songwriter, harmonica buff, ex-skydiver, writer-director, survivor of a lightning strike, violin player, truth seeker, lover of justice and love stories, prior ad agency copywriter, prior med student, part-time photographer, space and NASA addict, and cineast. Her debut feature, the micro-budget family comedy Death of a Saleswoman, won Best Feature, Best Director, Best Narrative, and Best Comedy at U.S. and Canadian festivals. It's in U.S. and international release. She's also an award-winning screenwriter and heads her own L.A.-based production company making films, transmedia, and digital projects that explore and expand diversity. One of Donna's specialties is packaging projects, and she approaches it from a more abstract reverse engineering perspective. So sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with producer Donna Wheeler.
First I was over by Sunset and the 101.
Yeah.
Two different places. And then I moved here about 4 or 5 years ago, and I love it. So, yeah.
Yeah, this is so central to everything.
Oh, yeah. And it's walking distance, so.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's still central to Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
Which makes it central to Santa Monica.
Of course.
Which makes it central to the valley.
Mm-hmm.
It's just central. But I never know. I have friends that live over here, and you never know if you get enough room. Like, do you feel like you have enough space?
Yeah, actually. I lucked out because this is a decent-sized apartment, and it's an okay building. And
it's quiet.
It's very quiet. Very nice, like a bunch of retired Russians in this neighborhood. So.
Yeah, I saw one guy walking out on the front there. He's, I don't know what he's doing.
Yeah.
I can tell he's retired. He's just ambling along.
And surprisingly, there are a lot of people walking dogs in this neighborhood. I don't know if you own an animal.
Same in my neighborhood, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, because I'll go out just for a walk at like 11 o'clock at night, or sometimes I'll be out at 1 in the morning. There's still people walking their dogs out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cheers.
Where's our margaritas?
Sorry, no margarita mix.
And we have a lot of the same mutual friends and all these different groups everyone belongs to. Like I saw briefly about you that you went to USC, so I'm sure you're part of that. There's a USC group.
Yeah, the USC Mafia.
Yeah. There's a Facebook group for USC.
For
the Mafia.
I'm a member of
those.
Which
is the new way of being in touch.
But I don't know how I feel about those Facebook groups. Because, you know, you sign up for, like, I need a producer. Mm-hmm. And then you wind up getting a lot of ads like, I have a script that needs funding, you know?
Really? So it's a hit and miss thing. It's not perfected, is it?
Exactly, yeah.
The best way is just to call your friends and say, who do you know?
Pretty much, yeah. I'm a member of a couple of Google groups, and those are more restricted. Like, one is for local coordinators 871.
Yeah.
And because it's union, you get a lot better response from that.
Right.
You know, people only post if they're looking for a legitimate crew personnel.
Yeah. Are you in one of the unions?
I'm in the PGA.
Because I have friends that are in that are posting different seminars and things that they're doing.
Okay.
Yeah, there are. So maybe I'll look at some Google groups instead. But anyway, I belong to a lot of those.
I'll send you some links. Yeah.
Yeah, please.
Definitely. So just so you're aware, like, this is a very conversational podcast.
It's no cigar.
No. Well, I no have cigar.
I want a cigar.
I have a cigar.
I won't smoke it during this, but I want one.
Oh well, I can give you one as a gift. Absolutely.
I'm so excited just for the cigar. I'm going to have it when I finish unboxing a whole bunch of crap at my new place and be like, I'm going to have a cigar.
Allow me to break out. Let's see.
You don't know how hard it is to move from one neighborhood to another.
All right. I've got, I can imagine, yeah. Last time I moved from one neighborhood to another was when I went from SC to Hollywood.
Right.
So I have a brick house, and I have this, which is unlabeled, which, ladies' choice.
I think the unlabeled one is...
All right.
Right?
Adventurer. There you go.
Oh. Do you know where it comes from?
Gosh, where did I get that? I actually got that from Cuban Made Cigars, which is right up the street.
And are there real Cubans making cigars?
Yeah. I mean, I found, because I went to, because the cigars they sell at Cuban Made Cigars, they tend to have a lot of spice to them. Mm-hmm. And then I actually went to Cannes a couple years ago, mm-hmm. and I smoked a Cuban cigar there, but it was very mild on the palate. So I don't know if it's just different flavors or if you can actually taste the difference, but...
What do you think? Have you had one of these?
I have had one of those. Whenever I buy cigars, I buy two at a time.
Yeah, to know what you're giving away.
Exactly.
So is this one considered mild? Is this one considered...
This one, I would say, is mild because of the coloring. So, mm-hmm. So how long have you been a cigar aficionado?
I think from the 90s, because before you were in the whole thing, there used to be the whole cigar bar as the way to set up your project. Did they ever talk about that?
No, but my God, I wish there had been. I wish I was around at that time.
I was thinking that you must have been, like, as a young child, like, somehow you knew. This would have all been in the late 90s?
Mm-hmm.
So what were you doing then? Like, where were you in 97?
I was starting high school.
Yeah, you weren't old enough to be with all these above 18-year-old. It was people like, I want to say it was not Tommy Lee Jones. Like, it was people like a lot of huge A-list guys, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
No women were in this thing. I mean, I would go because I was friends with the guys,
mm-hmm.
and they would say, well, we'll bring you as a token. You know, you'll be like a token. It's still like that in the film world. It's still like, oh yeah, you're the token.
Oh man, I'm sorry.
And I think it can. You see it at AFM. Mm-hmm. I think you see the cigar smokers, but it's not a thing. It used to be a thing.
Wow.
There were clubs all along Santa Monica that were the certain cigar hangout private things. And that's how you'd get in there and you'd talk to people about pitch. You'd pitch. You'd say, you know, this is what I have. What have you got?
Oh,
just sitting around smoking cigars.
Yeah, I don't think, because... You know, when I came out here in early 2000s, I kind of hit the networking world hard.
Yeah.
And then I don't think there are those kind of casual networking groups anymore. I think because of maybe the internet generation.
It might be that it just got replaced.
Yeah. It's sad in a way because I think we lost something, you know, nostalgic and romantic about Hollywood.
Yeah. There wasn't so much. You're right. You weren't. Now you can just do it all on the internet.
Well, you
even
can't.
Fax machines have been,
Yeah, well, you can't do it all on the internet because the internet has opened up to so many more crazies that it seems you have to validate yourself more.
Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, you can initiate things that you would have had to initiate at a cigar bar.
That's true.
And then you finish your deals at the various markets and the
mm-hmm.
festivals, depending on who you want to meet with.
So when did you come out to L.A.?
I was here in the 90s after grad school, and there wasn't a lot going on in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was saying either go New York or L.A., so I came out to L.A.
Nice.
And I was only coming out for 3 months, but see, I'm still here.
Okay, cool. So how did you... in those first 3 months, what happened? How did you fare? What were some of your surprising realizations?
Oh, it was really easy to, as long as you network, like we were just saying, and mm-hmm. Go to enough events, you can find your tribe
mm-hmm.
and hook up with your tribe and start making projects. So that's what happened in those 3 months. I think it happened within 30 days.
Wow.
That I went to, people were suggesting, oh, go to this, go to that.
Mm-hmm.
Without the internet.
Yeah.
I didn't have the internet. And I went and met... a group of filmmakers and started working on a documentary that Jodie Foster was going to be involved with and did that. And through that, just met enough people to keep working in the industry for the next several years.
Cool.
That's called It Was a Wonderful Life.
It Was a Wonderful Life.
It's about homeless women, homeless people, but I think we focused on just homeless women that were living on the streets of L.A.,
mm-hmm.
and each one of them had a story. So it was a fabric woven lifestyle piece about all these women and their life on the street. And they were average housewives who had become homeless.
Oh, wow.
So it was looking at how easily in the economy, our American economy, you can become homeless and what it does. Some of the women had children that they were living on the streets with children.
Yeah, yeah.
Because their husband had divorced them or...
And then you moved into the documentary world during the 90s, or were you also able to cross over into other media?
Yeah, back and forth between studio features at PolyGram and Disney and television. I worked in cable television, History Channel, Discovery Channel, the networks. Broadcast television.
Wow. Yeah. That's quite an accomplished resume. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. It was all from just knowing somebody who knew about this thing that was happening and they were looking for somebody. And
So let me ask you, what's your style of networking then, both as it compared to back then and then also now?
Well, now it's so different, you know, with social media.
Yeah.
It's just completely different. Before, it was driving to the actual thing and meeting the people. And you know, it's still always going to be this thing in Hollywood where you work with who you know and you work with who someone else knows and you work with people that you like and that you jive with, like what you were saying. So that style has remained the same no matter what. How we're connected, but now I see a lot of meetups now that you can do, you know, through meetup.com for film projects and crowdfunding gets people together where it didn't exist in the 90s. So I think I've trended with everything else with meeting people through social media or putting projects together using social media. I met a current producer type who I'm working with. I met through putting an ad on a social media site and then met her at AFM.
So let me ask you, when did you decide that you wanted to move more into packaging and putting together projects from that perspective?
I think that's after 2008. There was a, you know, market. There was many things that happened in 2008.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a series. It was kind of like a Titanic where there was a bunch of things waiting to happen and they all happened at the same time.
I was reading an article by Linda Opes the other day about this, where all at once there was the writers and the actors strikes. There was the crash of the DVD market.
Right.
And then also there was the recession all hitting at once.
Yes.
It was a perfect storm.
Yeah. And all these distribution models crashed and burned as well. Not only the end of DVD, but many of the distributors who had set up and gone gung-ho from 2005, you know, all the way up through 2007, those companies, many of those companies crashed or couldn't sustain the business model that they had set up a few years before that, especially with DVD going away and a lot of other channels went away as a way to reach the consumer. And then at the same time, there was positive things of the computer and the ways to get to your audience broadened. That was YouTube, you know, was created in 2006 and nobody was on. I joined it back then and it was sort of a wide open frontier. It still is wide open frontier. And you're thinking, I wonder what I should say and who I'm talking to because nobody was really on it. Yeah. A lot of things, but see how that shifted from 2006 to 2008. He sold the company.
Oh, okay.
The guy that created it sold it
to Google for a couple billion
and then
bucks.
And then it became additional backstory. And then it became a way to reach your audience. Nobody thought about it like that. Nobody thought, oh, someday this will become an actual channel where audience members will go to see content, which created then Hulu, which created Vudu, which created
Netflix streaming.
All these things were created in that same window when the economy was crashing. So through that, as filmmakers,
yeah,
we all saw that there were different trends. There were the landscape completely changes and has been changing every 6 months. I don't even want to say a time frame because it mm-hmm. even the time frame changes. So it's where you realize let's put on different hats and we need new skill sets and mm-hmm. maybe in our film school curriculum they didn't touch on any of this because it didn't exist. So let's go out. You know, you kind of have a spear or a stick and you're going through the woods and you're just parting all the foliage and saying, what's out here in this new wilderness?
Yeah, no, and also the rise of Kickstarter, too. I mean...
Right, crowdfunding, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what was the first project that you jumped on in this new space in 2008 that you said, this is, let us go and hunt yeah, the big buffalo?
It was, let's see, I was doing web series back then. Remember how web series were becoming a thing?
We actually did an episode with Kim Evey on The Guild.
So, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. See? Right. That was when a lot of those, remember the orange, what's the one, the something orange, anyway, a huge one in 2009.
Gotcha.
It was a huge one. What was, so there was a web series, it was, wasn't any one particular project that stands out. It was a multiple, everybody that I knew was like, let's do this, let's work on it. So I think I was doing an international-based spy comedy.
Oh, wow.
As a web series back then. I was also working on a documentary that was sectional. So it was a series-based documentary that would, in effect, be created by the audience.
Oh.
So the audience would add their video to it, so it would become this larger work. We were working on that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's still in there, but that's, you were saying, was there any one particular project? And I think you rise to the occasion of, hey, what are the tools now that I can use? What are the pencils and the paintbrushes that are available now as a filmmaker?
Mm-hmm.
And then you call up your friends and let's go make one of these because we can use YouTube, you know?
Yeah.
And I think because, remember, with the writers on strike and the actors on strike, a lot of content creators back then created series just for the web. Remember that?
That's true.
Because it was, you were allowed to put something on the internet.
It lasted, yeah, that strike lasted for a couple months and people just started throwing stuff up there.
Yeah, which revolutionized the industry, I think.
Yeah. So when you say you're a packaging producer, do you only package money and build projects from a social networking standpoint, or do you also approach talent as well?
Yeah, I think it's the whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
It's packaging now means, this is how I understand it to mean, is any creative aspect of the project. So the things I'm working or the ways that I'm doing it are similar to, I was reading a really good article about 12 Years a Slave in Hollywood Reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out back during just before Oscar season back in October.
Mm-hmm.
And it was talking about how that was a 6-year packaging and development process for that film.
Mm-hmm.
Which you always find out most of them are many years long and a lot of twists and turns. So what I read with that project, the production company was in talks with the director well before they even knew what movie they were going to make. And then didn't even have a book yet to base it on, but just knew this is kind of what we want to do. So then you get the book. That's one part of the package, right? You've got to go find some material. And then you find who's going to direct or who's going to act in it. So that's another part of it. And then you find who would be likely to finance this if we did it in this time frame. And that's another part of it. So I think as a producer now, you're even down to the music. If you've got a music-driven project, who's the band or the artist that's going to be contributing that. So that's what I've been working on, is all those different aspects of packaging, from the material to who's going to be behind this part of the film, which talent. It just becomes much more of a creative endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
just much more artistry is involved. Like mm-hmm. I was saying to you, producing is an artistic job because it's similar to a Broadway producer where you're finding material that nobody thought of or finding an artist that nobody's heard of. And mm-hmm. you're saying, look at this project we can put together with this. So to me, I take pride in being able to work in that arena because it's exciting, it's creative.
Okay. Let me ask you then, let me throw out an example. Let's say, for example, no, complete hypothetical, of course. Yes. I've got a horror film, takes place in New Orleans, mixed race cast, and it's can either be shot at the $1 million tier or the $3 million tier.
What's the price break? What's the best price point for this film to be made at so that the story comes across the best it can possibly be? Mm-hmm. What's the best way to tell this story? And then you backwards engineer it from there.
Mm-hmm.
So before I even started with the one or three, I would make sure that that's the right price point for the material mm-hmm. And then package it the way that it needs to be for its identity. And sometimes the film will tell you its identity. And sometimes it shifts and changes while you're packaging. That's why what I was going to say about mm-hmm. the long years that go into packaging, mm-hmm. often the film takes all these different shapes. Gravity is another great mm-hmm. Example that I've read recently where... it didn't come into being of that particular film until it couldn't be this one that they wanted originally or that one. And then they had to rewrite it because the technology, and then they had to rewrite it again. And then they had to change this and that because the technology, and then they had to wait. And they just kind of had to wait until technology was created that could do what they were thinking of and then move forward a little bit more. So often the packaging itself is a creative process of where are we at with this kind of material? Mm-hmm. What's my concept for how is the horror film different than other horror films or mm-hmm. or what kind of horror film is it? You know, that's a huge new landscape in itself. Different kinds of horror genres that are mixed.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I should have backed up my question then, which is how do you, as you're looking at a project, What are the other questions you ask yourself to say, what kind of price point is this?
Yeah, that's the best place to start, I think. And it's actually best, or what I do, is write it down. You go to the markets, mm-hmm. or if you can't go, you look and see who's at the markets. You can mm-hmm. find, luckily, we can find all that out.
Mm-hmm.
And you research who's doing similar projects to this that feel... in creative organically as the producer that feel the same
mm-hmm.
and so who should I be, what range should I be in, and who should I even be talking to after I get to the distribution phase? You can find that all out by who's making these and who's distributing ones that are similar
mm-hmm.
So you go and look and say, is it a Paranormal Activity or is it or is it in an Inception but horror based?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Remember Inception with all the special effects?
Of course, yeah.
So you've got that range, and then you package it appropriately. So if it's Paranormal Activity, you know that package, what that looks like. It's based on the script, it's based on clever use of editing and mm-hmm. cinematography and shots,
mm-hmm.
not even lighting, but just the choice of shots, the mm-hmm. choice of how many actors, the choice of location, all of that inform that film versus Inception, where we need big name actors or we need special effects, and therefore now we need big name actors because the special effects are going to require
mm-hmm.
a certain level of cost, and
mm-hmm.
and that's how I would approach it. Yeah.
And for you, it seems like the first journey, well, let's say, for example, that the person is not as experienced as you or I. Basically, one of the first things they could do as a resource is going through the markets, looking at similar films, similar posters, and then seeing what those ranges are done at.
Mm-hmm.
But then also, there's sometimes a lot of misinformation. I worked on one project, and the budget on IMDb is listed as $3.5 million.
And it wasn't.
No.
And when you look at Box Office Mojo or any of those other resources? Was it corrected later? Did you ever check?
You know what? We actually... that particular project was never released theatrically, so it was never listed on Box Office Mojo.
Oh.
But in addition, Box Office Mojo only paints a section because it only reports domestic box office.
Mm-hmm.
And so you never see what financials do internationally or DVD or streaming or those ancillary markets. So.
And I think, yeah, you can do your diligence and find that data if you look hard enough. And it's probably more common than we think that budgets are misreported on whatever sources. So what I would do to counteract that, I would check several different films and you can make a ballpark and also read, like we're saying, the case studies behind the films.
Mm-hmm.
Like Paranormal has had reported budgets of all over the map.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good to just maybe go back to some of the earlier articles and say, what was that real budget before they inflated it for the cost of publicity?
Of course, yeah.
But somewhere in there you can, and talk to friends who have made similar, a lot of friends of yours have probably made a similar film.
Of course.
And they
course.
Can tell you. So yeah, as a producer, you want to think of, where can I educate myself of what I need to do to protect this investment, make it a good business investment if I'm going to get a bunch of people involved and go look for this money and then get it distributed, like you were saying. Mm-hmm. Let's say that you decide it is 1 to 3 million.
Mm-hmm.
So then you would put together your package of either of those.
Mm-hmm.
You can have your 1 million package or your 3 million, or you could even have your 100,000 and your 1 to 3. And then you just need to find places to put it out there, to pitch it to, and find out who would be interested in that particular package.
Mm-hmm. And of course, those also can be kind of putting together your list of companies to
Your top 10 or your top 20 or your top 50.
But also you have to do your due diligence in terms of finding out if the company has an in-house financing deal, or if they have connections to financiers, or a studio deal, or if possibly they're just a soft services company where they can give soft money, but then you still have to find a third to half of the money and financing elsewhere. And then often some of these soft money companies, those kind of negotiations can be tricky because they are providing services. They will sometimes inflate their costs, add an additional producer's fee, and they want to be considered last money in, first money out status. Do you find that those kind of attachments are difficult, or do you think that they are worthwhile when looking for a soft services company?
I would say it all depends on the film and the project that you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking for every, I can think of all these various examples. For every example you can think of that where they did that sort of deal, there's many that worked out great. There's many that should have been some other deal. There's people that are just doing it by themselves. I think this past year I was at an event down, I think, in Orange County and heard about somebody that was waiting to get the last $200,000 for a $1 million film that was completely financed by non-industry benefactors.
Okay.
So
Russian mafia.
Right. No strings attached. Well, with them, there might be strings. So, you know, there's, and I think this has been ever since 2008 that you hear, for every story that you hear, somebody said, oh yeah, I linked up with XYZ soft company and I had this bad deal, or, oh, I had this great deal. For every one of those, you hear about somebody saying, yeah, my uncle Jimmy, he came into some money and we're making a movie.
There you go.
So I don't know, you know, it really depends on the project.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the art of it is trusting your instincts, always trusting your instincts mm-hmm. of what's going to be good for this project mm-hmm. And what's going to derail it. And you have a very good, you know, as a creative person, you have this intuitive sense. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's wrong. So
yeah,
nobody's 100%. Maybe someone is, but you have to allow yourself the latitude to say, I'm going to go with what I think is right. Mm-hmm.
So what do you see as some of the overall trends in packaging projects moving forward?
I'm hearing stuff out of Berlin, because mm-hmm. that market just passed in February. And mm-hmm. and then I was trying to see what was happening at South by Southwest. I don't know if you looked at any of the films coming out of there. Some of those already had deals. But the trends right now seem to be still the same of, well, I guess there was a little bit of a shift. What I heard is there's been a little shift in the quality has to be much higher now for mm-hmm. projects that get financed by foreign sales agents or foreign entities that have money to hand out. Mm-hmm. So they want a higher level of quality. They want a better script. They want better packaging, mm-hmm. better stars. Better concept, I was going to say, a better hook, a more realized marketing plan mm-hmm. that's more thought out. Mm-hmm.
So when you say that, do they want higher quality, but do they still want the same amount of money?
No, and they want to pay less.
They want to pay less, more quality for less.
Yeah.
But that's...
I think that could be a sign that the economy is shifting and getting better.
Really?
How so? Because I think two years ago or 3 years ago at Cannes, mm-hmm. was it 2010 or 2011, that nobody was doing any deals?
Yeah. I remember there was one article about AFM a couple years ago, and they literally described the hallways as a ghost town.
Yeah. So there was a couple of years of mm-hmm. the fallout of 2008 mm-hmm. where just everything was flat and it was a global recession. It wasn't just the U.S.
Of course,
so it was affecting countries that for years after, they still had limited resources. And art, you know, is one of the first things sometimes to go. And so I think the shift is almost a natural... I'm not an economist, mm-hmm. but it seems mm-hmm. natural that... Okay, now that we've been buying a lot of things that are mid quality, now we want to pay less and get better quality. Seems like a good reaction to the mm-hmm. market being saturated maybe with the prior projects, because we know that there's money.
It's a buyer's market.
I think just like the housing market, it's shifted around a little bit. I wouldn't be discouraged. I would just spend more effort in your packaging. Mm-hmm. You know, now with that trend happening, you know, okay, I've really got to be astute about what I'm putting together mm-hmm. and take the time to make it a good package.
Okay. And making a good package is, of course, your acting, your directing, your your keys, if you will, your DP and your sound people and your music people.
And keeping your budget appropriate for all of that mm-hmm. and appropriate for the script mm-hmm. and concept.
Of course.
You know, because it's an execution of a script, so...
I'm kind of curious, because, like, the idea of packaging something is really interesting to me, particularly for people at kind of an independent level who, like you said, their only resource is, oh, their uncle came into some money, you know? And in looking at how you package a product to eventually take it to market, what if I were to just pose you some hypotheticals about my horror story in New Orleans? And we just kind of spitball ideas for it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And again, this is not an actual script I control. I'm just throwing out stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, script takes place in New Orleans, one contained location, female lead, you mm-hmm. know, male supporting and a female supporting. And it's only about 90 pages long, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
So under that... You know, it's definitely designed to be contained as a horror film.
Mm-hmm.
So it could probably be done for a low budget.
It sounds like it, yeah. One location, mm-hmm. not too many actors in the cast, mm-hmm. the genre. Mm-hmm. Are you choosing New Orleans in this hypothetical for the tax incentive reasons or because it has the mood and the location, the aura of the...
I think it's a combination of both. It's a combination of both. You can certainly take advantage of the tax incentives. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, there have been places they shoot, you know, Georgia for Texas or mm-hmm. they shoot wherever, you know. So getting around location incentives isn't always a top issue.
Right.
So
it's more about the look of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So then... I would say figure out what that budget is going to be, mm-hmm. right? And you've got to build in the transportation and logistics of mm-hmm. the crew, the cast, mm-hmm. hiring, mm-hmm. working remotely. Mm-hmm. And then it's a... I think then it's a matter of... I would also, if it were me, figure out distribution ahead of time. That's mm-hmm. trend that's been for the last several years.
By distribution, you mean
make that part of your package.
Wide theatrical versus limited theatrical. No.
Who? Just who?
Oh, just the companies. Your top 10 or your top 20.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. actually talk to them about it.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that it's something that they're looking for and are going to be a potential place to go to.
Mm-hmm.
Or even do they want to be involved ahead of time?
Okay.
Because that's part of a package as well, or can be.
In terms of getting either a pre-sales agreement or a letter of interest? Or
mm-hmm. Any of those? Or mm-hmm. yeah, or they might come in with whatever they might negotiate to come in with.
What would be the ideal deal in talking with one of these distributors?
The ideal deal is they just write you a blank check and say, yeah, no, call us when you're done.
Okay, let me rephrase that. The ideal realistic deal.
Okay, let's see. Something that gives you a good ability to, I think this is something I read too about one of these recent movies that mm-hmm. have been made that were in the Oscars race. You want to give your team good latitude to realize the vision of the story, mm-hmm. of the script and the story.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody on the same page. So figure out how to get that deal, mm-hmm. right? What's the deal that's going to allow my director, my talented director that I've hired to, you know, work their magic, what they're mm-hmm. good at.
Yeah.
So a deal that stops that might not be a great deal or an ideal deal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I would be looking for...
As far as, not to pull out, you know, true examples, because I wouldn't want you to expose mm-hmm. your clients and what have you, but what would be some examples of, you know, bad deals that would limit your creative personnel? I mean, obviously, there's like, oh, an orange Tang has to be in every shot of
right.
the movie. Like,
that's one of them. or change your characters to this. And mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, there, yeah. A really good example that I heard recently, I think we're allowed to talk about it because I heard it at a public mm-hmm. talk back.
Oh, okay.
Was Iron Man 3.
Mm-hmm.
And initially, that film was going to be green screen for the stunts.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Originally.
Uh-huh.
And the stunt department convinced the studio executives who were in charge of that sort of decision-making to instead do it live with actual stunts on location, like doing the skydiving stunts.
Oh, okay.
For real.
Wow.
Instead of putting it in front of green screen and just having the actors all in harnesses with wires that they mm-hmm. would then rotoscope out later,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
they went ahead and proved, essentially the stunt department went off and proved to the studio that it made sense financially and in a packaging sense. They almost were acting as part of the producing staff by saying, look, here's what it'll look like. We all know this is what it'll look like in cost if we do it green screen. But this, and they went out and shot the actual test footage. They took like five scenes out of this, or five pages out of the script, and shot the actual scene at the skydiving camp with world class skydivers, brought that footage back and said, this is what it would cost and this is what it would look like to do it this way. And it was clearly better. And it would have been restrictive. And they showed why. Why is it better? Why does it tell this story better to do it this way? Look at this. This is actual factual data. That can be a very valuable tool or thing to do. And you can think about it as a producer in a smaller way. If you had to show some company, look, this isn't going to work for me, and they say, no, but it will, and you can show them why. Sometimes they may agree.
Gotcha. Okay.
So that's a good story. I think it's a inspiring story just on the face of it to say, you know, just because this is the conventional way to do it, this is going to be a better way. More people are going to come see this movie. More people are going to enjoy the movie. It's about, you know, falling out of airplanes. So shouldn't we just do what...
And you'd said also as part of your package, it's good to have a good idea of a marketing plan before you even start production necessarily.
Yeah, another thing that you would sit down and write out.
So what are... Because that's another thing, like, you know, with pitches a while back, you hear like, oh, it's, you know, it's good to go in with a spec poster, for example, or a spec trailer.
It still is.
Yeah.
The trailer thing for the last couple of years, I think it can go either way. Depends on why you're doing it and how germane it is to your package. So, like the skydiving example, if that were your hypothetical film and it relies on that so much as part of the superpowers of the characters, then you can storyboard it. Then you can do the animation storyboards. And then going out there and making like a little demo. For us, that's a very dangerous thing. We wouldn't be working in that arena, but or maybe we would be if we hired those people. But yeah, making some kind of little, that's what the trailer functions as, right? It can be like, this is what we can pull off. I don't know that it's always applicable, but the marketing materials, yes.
It sounds like from a trailer perspective, at least, that it would benefit from a CGI movie, but not necessarily for like a character drama or a relatively low budget movie.
Yeah, unless, I just heard this example the other day, unless somebody's asking for it on the end of green lighting, saying, oh, we want to see something like that.
Okay.
And then your green light is there. So then, yeah, it's relevant.
And then in constructing your marketing plan, what other aspects would you want to think about? I mean, one of the things that comes to my mind is, of course, like your EPK and behind-the-scenes specials, which they used to do on HBO all the time. I don't know if they still do. But then also there's things like, you know, if, for example, you're making a horror movie based on a haunted house in old New Orleans. I know, beating a dead horse. But if you're making something based on that, then one of the good strategies might be to go to the History Channel and work with them on focusing on tie-in like haunted house specials to tie in with your film in coordination with the release.
Yeah, that's a great idea. That really adds a lot of value. It also targets your niche audience. It would be built in. It demonstrates your hook to people in a way that's original. And yeah.
And kind of thinking about this, do you also consider how to best structure the Facebook and Twitter question? Not just, do we have one? Because nowadays,
yeah, you just have one, right? Yeah.
but how do you decide what goes on there necessarily?
Yeah, I think that you have a plan for that. I think it's really important to have a strategy for that, or to, I know, like it's become the filmmaker, all of us, let's say we're the content creators. We have to now be all these different departments that formerly were subbed out, that we weren't so involved with, but now because there's this direct-to-consumer ability.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you are a marketing department, you and your team. Mm-hmm. So it's not all just one person alone, but mm-hmm. you and your team are a marketing department, and you're thinking strategically based on other models or other good examples that fit.
Mm-hmm.
How should I do this? So I do think there's a lot of publicity people that can be brought into this
to mix. The package.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
Good thing to look at, or a marketing consultant. I've seen people that are now just consultants for social media. Mm-hmm. They have their own title, and I can't remember what it is. But,
all right, cool. So what do you think is the biggest mistake a lot of independent filmmakers make when they're looking at their packaging in the initial development stage?
Maybe not taking the time to write these things out, like what we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
as a good thing to do. Like, write out, who am I talking to? Who's this for? Who's mm-hmm. What's my hook? What makes it interesting and unique?
Mm-hmm.
What's my plan distribution for this? Why is that my plan?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of asking yourself why, mm-hmm. just like in film school when the professors would always pin us down and say, well, why did you make it this way? And why did you, mm-hmm. why are you using a crane for this?
They let you have cranes in film school?
Yeah, didn't you have them? If you could justify it.
Yeah.
You had to justify.
Gotcha.
So I think writing out your marketing plan. There's like each time I have a project, I have this binder of, and it's all in its various sections of these things that we're talking about, and mm-hmm. writing it all out and planning it.
Yeah.
You need that blueprint. You need your business model because mm-hmm. it's such a complicated endeavor that goes across so many years with so many people.
Of course.
So I think one of the mistakes maybe, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know what everyone's doing out there, but one of them I could imagine is not taking the time to do enough of that ahead of time. And then, so maybe Uncle Jimmy calls you and says, hey, I've got that windfall that you've been looking for. Here, I'm sure you have some script ready, and you just take the first script off the top or something that you've been wanting to make without a plan and just go. So now you have this film that you have to backwards engineer almost mm-hmm. of how you're going to do all these things. And now it's pretty much cemented as to what it is. So mm-hmm. I suppose you could do it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe if Uncle Jimmy calls, you don't need any of this advice.
So, okay, then last question. What should an unemployed actor goes out on auditions, adjusts their headshots, goes to classes. An unemployed writer works on their spec scripts. What should an unemployed producer do?
Wow, there's so much. Like it's a never-ending... you would be attending... I'm going to think of the top... few things. You'd be attending the festivals and all the things that we're so fortunate in LA to have.
Mm-hmm.
Every symposium and panel and this and that. And so, yeah, make sure you're going and you're interacting with people, like we said, in person, face to face, finding out who's making what and how they're doing it. And does it apply to anything you're making? Making new connections for new projects that are mm-hmm. going to be coming in the future. So mm-hmm. let's say you meet somebody, you're going to network about the project you're doing now, and you meet somebody that you're going to make a project with 5 years from now
mm-hmm.
at the same place.
Mm-hmm.
So there's expanding your network all the time, attending the markets, the festivals out of town as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all that travel that we get to do.
Mm-hmm. A tax write-off.
Right? And it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
Being at Cannes, like you were at Cannes, it's fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
French Riviera.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Can't knock it. The food's great. And I think always like being open to new sources of material mm-hmm. coming your way. Whether it's a book or an article that you're reading, just because you're in line at the post office and you're reading something. If you're just always open to some new material coming your way, or a conversation that you have with somebody that you're just catching up with them, and then suddenly you guys have an idea for something that should always be going on.
And that's all, folks. Many thanks to my guest, Donna Wheeler, for a terrific interview. Just to reiterate, I am not producing a horror film in New Orleans, but I've done budget breakdowns for 3 New Orleans-based horror films in the past year, and you'd be surprised how similar those projects can be. You can find out more about Donna's feature projects and transmedia projects by visiting the links for this episode on our website. Our music this week is Le Charleston by Andrea Lindsay. You can buy a copy by following the iTunes link on this episode's page. We're starting to grow our Producers Lounge community, so if you'd like to submit either jazz music or banner photos for an episode, post a link on our Facebook page. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/theproducerslounge. Remember, you show your support for films by not downloading them, you show your support on Hulu by clicking on the commercials, and you show your support for podcasts by liking and commenting. And you can always check out our website, www.theproducersloungepodcast.com. Thank you again. I'm your host, Richard Tucci. Join us next week for more cocktails and questions. And until then, keep producing dreams.